anymore. There's only here.
Lale stands up and stares at her.
My name is Ludwig Eisenberg, but people call me Lale. I come from Krompachy, Slovakia. I have a mother, a father, a brother, and a sister. He pauses. Now, it's your turn.
Gita meets his stare defiantly.
I am prisoner 34902 in Birkenau, Poland.
Conversation fades into uneasy silence. He watches her, her downcast eyes. She is struggling with her thoughts, what to say, what not to say.
Lale sits back down, in front of her this time. He reaches out as if to take her hand, before withdrawing it.
I don't want to upset you, but will you promise me one thing?
What?
Before we leave here, you will tell me who you are and where you come from.
She looks him in the eyes.
Yes, I promise.
I'm happy with that for now. So they've got you working in the Canada? Gita nods.
Is it okay there?
It's okay.
But the Germans just throw all the prisoners' possessions in together. Rotten food mixed with clothing and the mold. I hate touching it and it stinks.
I'm glad you're not outside. I've spoken to some men who know girls from their village who also work in the Canada. They tell me they often find jewels and money.
I've heard that. I just seem to find moldy bread.
You will be careful, won't you? Don't do anything silly. And always keep your eye on the SS.
I've learned that lesson well, trust me.
A siren sounds.
You'd better get back to your block, says Lale. Next time I'll bring some food for you. You have food?
I can get extra.
I'll get it to you.
And I'll see you next Sunday.
Lale stands and holds his hand out to Gita. She takes it.
He pulls her to her feet, holds her hand a moment longer than he should. He can't take his eyes off her.
We should go.
She breaks eye contact, but maintains her spell over him with a smile that makes his knees go weak. Chapter 6. Weeks have gone by. The trees surrounding the camp have dropped their leaves. The days have become shorter as winter advances.
Who are these people?
Lale has been asking himself this question ever since he arrived in the camp.
These groups of men who work on the construction sites, who appear every day dressed in civilian clothing, never to be seen after tools down.
With a spring in his step from his time with Gita, Lale feels sure he can talk to a couple of the men without the SS getting worked up and taking a shot at him. And he has his bag-shaped shield. Lale strolls casually towards one of the new brick buildings under construction. These don't seem to be blocks to house prisoners, but their use is of no concern to Lale today.
He approaches two men, one older than the other, busily engaged in bricklaying, and squats down beside a pile of bricks awaiting placement. The two men watch him with interest, slowing their work rate.
Lale picks up a brick and pretends to study it.
I don't get it, he speaks quietly.
What don't you get?
The older man asks.
I'm a Jew. They've branded me with a yellow star. Around me I see political prisoners, murderers and lazy men who won't work, and then you.
You wear no brand.
That's none of your business, Jew boy,
says the younger man. Himself no more than a boy.
Just being friendly. You know how it is. Checking out my surrounds, and I became curious about you and your friends. My name is Lale.
Get lost,
the young one says.
Settle down, boy. Don't mind him.
the older man says to Lale, his voice rough from too many cigarettes.
My name's Victor. The mouth is my son, Yuri.
Victor extends his hand, which Lale shakes. Lale then offers his hand to Yuri, but he doesn't take it.
We live nearby, Victor explains. So, we come here to work each day.
I just want to get this straight. You come here each day voluntarily. I mean, you're paid to be here.
Yuri pipes up.
That's right, Jew boy. We get paid and go home every night. You lot... I said shut it, Yuri. Can't you see the man's just being friendly?
Thanks, Victor. I'm not here to cause trouble. Like I said, just checking things out.
What's the bag for?
Snaps Yuri, smarting at having been reprimanded in front of Lale.
My tools. My tools for tattooing the numbers on the prisoners. I'm the tatoviera.
Busy job, quips Victor.
Some days. I never know when transports are coming, or how big.
I hear there's worse to come.
Are you prepared to tell me?
This building. I've seen the plans. You're not going to like what it is.
Surely it can't be any worse than what goes on here already.
Lale now stands, bracing himself on the pile of bricks.
It's called... Crematorium 1,
Victor says quietly and looks away.
Crematorium 1, with the possibility of a number 2.
Sorry, I said you wouldn't like it.
Lale punches the last brick laid, sending it flying, and shakes his hand in pain.
Victor reaches into a nearby bag and produces a piece of dried sausage wrapped in wax paper.
Here, take this. I know they're starving you people, and I got plenty where this came from.
That's our lunch,
Yuri cries, rushing to take the sausage from his father's outstretched hand. Victor pushes Yuri away.
It won't hurt you to go without for a day. This man needs it more.
I'm going to tell Mum when we get home.
You'd better hope I don't tell her about your attitude. You've got a lot to learn about being civilized, young man. Let this be your first lesson.
Lale still hasn't taken the sausage.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cause trouble.
Well, you have, wails a petulant Yuri. No, he hasn't, says Victor.
Lale, take the sausage. And come and see us again tomorrow. I'll have more for you.
Hell, if we can help just one of you, we'll do it. Right, Yuri?
Yuri reluctantly extends his hand to Lale, who takes it.
Save the one. Save the world,
Lale says quietly, more to himself than the others.
I can't help you all.
Lale takes the food.
I don't have anything to pay you with.
That's not a problem.
Thank you. There might be a way I can pay you, though. If I find a way, can you get me anything else? Like chocolate?
He wanted chocolate. That's what you give a girl, if you can get it.
I'm sure we can work something out. You'd better move on. There's an officer paying us a bit of attention.
See you.
Lale says as he shoves the sausage in his bag. Stray snowflakes drift around him as he walks back to his block.
The flakes catching the last rays of the sun, bouncing strobes of light that remind him of a kaleidoscope he played with as a boy.
What's wrong with this picture?
Lale is overcome with emotion as he hurries back to his block.
On his face, the melted snow is indistinguishable from the tears. The winter of 1942 has arrived.
Back in his room, Lale takes the chunk of sausage and breaks it carefully into even parts.
He tears strips from the wax paper,
and wraps each piece tightly before placing them back in his bag.
As he comes to the last piece, Lale stops and considers the small, fulfilling parcel of food sitting there next to his rough, dirty fingers.
These fingers that used to be smooth and clean and plump, that handled rich food, that he used to hold up to tell hosts, "No, thank you, I couldn't possibly have any more." With a shake of his head, he places it too into the bag. He heads towards one of the Canada buildings. He once asked a man in Block 7 if he knew why they called these sorting rooms by that name. "The girls who work there dream of a place far away where there is plenty of everything and life can be what they want it to be. They've decided Canada is such a place."
Lale has spoken to a couple of girls working in this Canada.
He has checked everyone exiting many times and knows Gita doesn't work here. There are other buildings he cannot easily access. She must work in one of those. He spies two girls he has spoken to before, walking together. He reaches into his bag, withdraws two parcels and approaches them, smiling. He turns and walks alongside them.
"I want you to put out one of your hands, but do it slowly. I'm going to give you a parcel of sausage. Do not open it until you're alone."
The two girls do as he says, not breaking step, their eyes darting about for SS who might be watching them. Once the sausage is in their hands, they wrap their arms across their chests, as much to keep themselves warm as to protect their gift.
"Girls, I've heard you sometimes find jewels and money, is that correct?"
The women exchange a glance.
"Now, I don't want to put you at risk, but do you think there's any way you could smuggle a little of it out to me?"
One of them says nervously,
"Shouldn't be too hard. Our minders don't pay much attention to us anymore. They think we're harmless."
"Great. Just get what you can without causing suspicion, and with it, I will buy you and others food like this sausage."
"Do you think you could get some chocolate?"
one of them says, her eyes bright.
"Can't promise, but I'll try. Remember, only take small quantities at a time. I'll try and be here tomorrow afternoon. If I'm not, is there somewhere safe you can hide things until I can get to you?"
"Not in our block, we can't do that. We get searched all the time,"
one replies.
"I know,"
says the other.
"The snow is piling up at the back of our block. We can wrap it in a rag and hide it there when we go to the toilet."
"Yeah, that will work,"
the first one says.
"You can't tell anyone what you're doing, or where you're getting the food from, okay? It's really important. Your lives depend on you saying nothing. Got that?"
One of the girls draws her finger across her closed mouth. As they near the women's compound, Lale splits off from them and loiters outside Block 29 for a short while. There is no sign of Gita. So it must be. But it will be Sunday again in 3 days' time. The next day, Lale completes his work at Birkenau within a few hours. Leon asks him to spend the afternoon with him, wanting the opportunity to talk about their situation without a block full of men straining to hear every word. Lale begs off, saying he isn't feeling well and needs to get some rest. They go their separate ways.
He is conflicted. He desperately wants whatever food Victor has brought, but he needs something to pay him with. The girls finish work around the same time Victor and the other visiting workers leave. Will he have enough time to see if they have managed to lift anything? In the end, he decides to visit Victor and reassure him that he's working on obtaining a source of payment.
Bag in hand, Lale makes his way over to the block under construction. He looks around for Victor and Yuri. Victor sees him and nudges Yuri to follow as they separate from the other workers. Slowly they approach Lale, who has stopped and is pretending to be looking for something in his bag. With an outstretched hand, Yuri greets Lale.
"His mother had a word with him last night," offers Victor.
"I'm sorry, I haven't been able to get anything to pay you with,
but I hope to have something very soon. Please don't bring anything else until I've paid you for what you've given me already.
It's okay. We have plenty to spare, Victor says.
No, you're taking a risk. At the very least, you should get something in return. Just give me a day or two.
Victor takes from his bag two packages, which he drops into Lale's open bag.
We'll be here at the same time tomorrow.
Thank you, says Lale.
See you,
says Yuri, which makes Lale smile.
See you, Yuri.
Back in his room, Lale opens the packages. Sausage and chocolate. He holds the chocolate to his nose and inhales.
Once again, he breaks the food into small pieces to make it easy for the girls to hide and pass around.
Oh, how he hopes they'll be discreet.
The consequences, if they aren't, don't bear thinking about. He saves a small amount of the sausage for Block 7. The tools down siren interrupts his obsessive efforts to ensure each piece of food is exactly the same size. He throws everything into his bag and hurries towards the Canada.
Not far from the women's compound, Lale catches up with his two friends.
They see him coming and slow their pace, dropping back into the mob of girls trudging home. He holds the food bundles in one hand, the open bag in the other, and nudges his way through the girls. Without looking at him, each girl drops something into his bag, and he in turn presses the food into their hands, which they shove up their sleeves.
Lale and the girls split away from each other at the entrance into the women's compound. Lale doesn't know what he will find in the four pieces of rag that he places on his bed.
He opens them gently. They contain coins and notes of Polish złoty, loose diamonds, rubies and sapphires, gold and silver rings emblazoned with precious stones.
Lale steps back, knocking into the door behind him.
He is recoiling from the sad provenance of these objects, each one attached to a momentous event in the life of its previous owner. He is also scared for his own safety. If he is discovered with this bounty, he will surely be put to death. A noise outside makes him throw the jewels and currency back in his bag and himself on his bed. No one comes in. Eventually, he rises and takes his bag with him towards his evening meal. In the canteen, he doesn't place his bag at his feet as usual, but clings to it with one hand, trying not to look too strange. He suspects he fails. Later that night, he separates the precious stones from the money, the loose gems from the jewelry, wrapping them separately in the rags they came in. The majority of the loot he pushes under his mattress. He keeps a loose ruby and a diamond ring in his bag.
At 7 the next morning, Lale hangs around the main compound gates as the local workers enter. He sidles up to Victor and opens his hand to reveal the ruby and the ring. Victor closes his hand over Lale's in a handshake, palming the jewels. Lale's bag is already open and Victor quickly transfers some packages into it. Their alliance is now sealed. Victor whispers,
"Happy New Year."
Lale trudges away, the snow now falling heavily and covering the camp. 1943 has begun.
Chapter 7.
Though it's bitterly cold and the compound is a mess of snow and mud, Lale is upbeat. It is a Sunday. Lale and Gita will be among the brave souls walking in the compound, in the hope of a fleeting meeting, a word, a touch of the hand.
He is pacing, on the lookout for Gita, as he attempts to keep the cold from his bones. He walks in front of the women's camp as often as he can without raising suspicion. Several girls come from Block 29, but no Gita. Just as he is about to give up, Dana appears, scanning the compound.
Spotting Lale, she hurries over.
"Gita's sick,"
she says as soon as she's in earshot.
"She's sick,
Lale.
I don't know what to do.
His heart lurches to his throat in panic as he remembers the death cart, the close call, the men who nursed him back to health.
I have to see her. You can't go in. Our capo is in a terrible mood. She wants to call the SS and have them take Gita away. You can't let them. You mustn't let them take her, please. Dana, says Lale. What's wrong with her, do you know? We think it's typhus. We've lost several girls in our block this week.
Then she needs medicine. Penicillin.
And where are we going to get medicine, Lale? If we go to the hospital and ask for penicillin, they'll just take her away. I can't lose her. I've lost all my family. Please, can you help us, Lale?
Dana pleads. Don't take her to the hospital. Whatever you do, don't go there. Lale's mind races. Listen to me, Dana. It's going to take me a couple of days, but I'm going to try and get her some penicillin.
A numbness sweeps over him. His vision blurs. His head pounds.
Here's what you have to do. Tomorrow morning, take her, however you can, carry, drag, whatever, but take her to the Canada. Hide her there among the clothes in the day and try and get as much water into her as you can. Then bring her back to your block for roll call. You might have to do this for a few days until I can get medicine, but you must do it. It's the only way to stop her being taken to the hospital. Now go and look after her. All right, I can do that. Ivana will help, but she must have medicine.
He grips Dana's hand.
Tell her.
Dana waits.
Tell her. I will take care of her.
Lale watches Dana run back into her block. He can't move.
Thoughts creep into his head. The death cart he sees every day. Black Mary, it's called. She cannot end up on there. That must not be her fate. He looks around at the brave souls who have ventured outside. He imagines them dropping into the snow and lying there, smiling up at him, thankful that death has taken them from this place.
You cannot have her. I will not let you take her from me, he calls.
Prisoners move away from him. The SS have chosen to stay inside on this bleak, dark day, and soon Lale finds himself alone, paralyzed by cold and fear.
Finally, he begins to move his feet. His mind rejoins the rest of his body, and he stumbles back to his room and collapses on his bed. Daylight creeps into his room the next morning. The room feels empty, even of him. Looking down from above, he does not see himself. An out-of-body experience.
Where have I gone? I have to come back. There's something important for me to do.
The memory of yesterday's meeting with Dana jolts him back to reality. He grabs his bag, his boots, throws a blanket on his shoulders and runs from his room to the front gates. He doesn't check who is around. He must get to Victor and Yuri immediately.
The two men arrive with others in their detail, sinking into the snow with each step they take towards work. They see Lale and move away from the others, meeting him halfway.
He shows Victor the gems and the currency in his hand, a small fortune's worth. Everything he has, he drops into Victor's bag.
Penicillin or something similar, Lale says. Can you help me?
Victor places his packages of food into Lale's open bag and nods his head.
Yes.
Lale hurries over to Block 29 and watches from a distance.
Where are they? Why haven't they appeared?
He paces up and down, oblivious to the eyes in the towers surrounding the camp. He must see Gita. She has to have made it through the night. Finally, he sees Dana and Ivana, Gita hanging weakly from their shoulders. Two other girls help to block the scene from easy view.
Lale drops to his knees at the thought this could be the last time he sees her.
What are you doing down there?
Boretsky appears behind him.
He staggers to his feet. I was feeling sick, but I'm okay now.
Maybe you should see a doctor. You know we have several at Auschwitz.
No. Thanks. I'd rather ask you to shoot me. Baretsky withdraws his pistol from its holster.
If this is where you want to die, Tatoviera, I would be happy to oblige.
I'm sure you would. But not today,
Lale says.
I take it we've got work to do. Baretsky holsters his gun.
Auschwitz,
he says as he begins walking. And take that blanket back to where you found it. You look ridiculous.
Lale and Leon spend the morning at Auschwitz, tattooing numbers on frightened newcomers and attempting to soften the shock of it. But Lale's mind is on Gita, and several times he presses too hard. In the afternoon when the job is finished, Lale half walks, half runs back to Birkenau.
He meets Dana near the entrance to Block 29 and gives her all his rations from breakfast.
We made a bed for her out of clothing,
Dana says, as she folds the food into makeshift shirt cuffs.
And we fed her water from pieces of snow. We took her back to the block this afternoon, but she's still in a really bad way.
Lale squeezes Dana's hand.
Thank you. Try and get some food into her. I'll have medicine tomorrow.
He departs, his mind a whirlpool.
I barely know Gita. Yet how can I live if she does not?
That night, sleep evades him.
The next morning, Victor places medicine, along with food, into Lale's bag.
That afternoon, he's able to get it to Dana. In the evening, Dana and Ivana sit beside a now fully unconscious Gita. The pull of typhus is stronger than they are. The black stillness has completely overtaken her. They talk to her, but she gives no sign that she hears them. From a small vial, Dana places several drops of liquid into Gita's mouth as Ivana holds it open.
I don't think I can keep carrying her to the Canada,
an exhausted Ivana says.
She will get better,
Dana insists.
Just a few more days. Where did Lale get the medicine from? We don't need to know. Just be grateful that he did. Do you think it's too late? I don't know, Ivana. Let's just hold her tight and get her through the night.
The next morning, Lale watches from a distance as Gita is once again carried towards the Canada.
He sees her attempt to raise her head on a couple of occasions and is overjoyed at the sight. He now needs to seek out Baretsky.
The main SS officers' quarters are at Auschwitz. There is just a small building for them at Birkenau, and it is there that Lale goes in the hope of catching Baretsky as he is coming or going. He appears after several hours and seems surprised to see Lale waiting for him.
Not enough work for you, eh?
Baretsky asks.
I have a favor to ask, Lale blurts out.
Baretsky narrows his eyes.
I won't do any more favors.
Maybe one day I can do something for you.
Baretsky laughs.
What could you possibly do for me?
You never know. But wouldn't you like to bank a favor? Just in case.
Baretsky sighs.
What do you want?
It's Gita.
Your girlfriend.
Can you get her transferred from the Canada into the administration building?
Why? I suppose you want her where there's heating?
Yes.
Baretsky taps a foot.
It might take me a day or two, but I'll see what I can do. No promises.
Thank you.
You owe me, Tatoviera.
The smirk is back as he fondles his swagger stick.
You owe me.
With more bravado than he feels, Lale says,
Not yet I don't, but I hope to.
He walks away, a small spring in his step. Perhaps he can make Gita's life a little more bearable.
The following Sunday, Lale walks slowly alongside a recovering Gita.
He wants to put his arm around her like he saw Dana and Ivana do, but he daren't. It's good enough to be near her. It doesn't take long for her to be exhausted, and it's too cold to sit.
She wears a long woolen coat, no doubt something the girls have appropriated from the Canada with no objection from the SS. It has deep pockets, and Lale fills them with food before he sends her back to her block to rest.
The following morning, a trembling Gita is escorted into the main administration building by an SS officer. The young woman has been told nothing, and she automatically fears the worst. She has been sick, and now she is weak. Clearly, the authorities have decided she is no longer of use. As the officer speaks to a more senior colleague, Gita looks around the large room. It is filled with drab green desks and filing cabinets. Nothing is out of place. What strikes her most is the warmth. The SS work here too, so of course there is heating. A mixture of female prisoners and female civilians work quickly and quietly, writing, filing, heads down. The escorting officer directs Gita towards her colleague, and Gita stumbles, still suffering the after effects of the typhus. The colleague breaks her fall before roughly shoving her away. She then grabs Gita's arm and inspects her tattoo, before dragging her towards an empty desk and shoving her down on a hard wooden chair, next to another prisoner, dressed just like her. The girl doesn't look up, only tries to make herself smaller, unobtrusive, so as to be ignored by the officer.
"Put her to work!"
the grumpy officer barks. Once they're alone, the girl shows Gita a long list of names and details. She hands her a pile of cards and indicates that she is to transcribe the details of each person first onto a card and then into a large leather-bound book between them. No words are spoken, and a quick glance around the room tells Gita to keep her mouth shut too.
Later that day, Gita hears a familiar voice and looks up. Lale has entered the room and is handing papers to one of the civilian girls working on the front desk.
Finishing his conversation, he slowly scans all the faces. As his glance passes Gita, he winks. She can't help herself. She gasps, and a few women turn to look at her.
The girl beside her nudges her in the ribs as Lale hurries from the room. With the day's work ended, Gita sees Lale standing a distance away, watching the girls leave the administration building for their blocks.
The heavy SS presence prevents him from approaching. As the girls walk together, they talk.
"I'm Silka," Gita's new colleague says. "I am in Block 25. I'm Gita, Block 29.
As the girls enter the women's camp, Dana and Ivana rush to Gita.
"Are you all right? Where did they take you? Why did they take you?"
Dana demands, fear and relief on her face.
"I'm okay. They took me to work in the administration office."
"How?"
Ivana asks.
"Lale. I think he somehow arranged it." "But you're all right? They didn't hurt you?"
"I'm fine. This is Silka. I'm working with her."
Dana and Ivana greet Silka with a hug. Gita smiles, happy that her friends are so immediately accepting of another girl in their midst. All afternoon she had worried how they would react to her now working in relative comfort, without having to deal with the cold or any physical effort. She could hardly blame them if they were jealous of her new role, and felt she was no longer one of them.
"I'd better go to my block," says Silka. "I'll see you tomorrow, Gita."
Silka walks off and Ivana watches her go.
"Gosh, she's pretty. Even dressed in rags, she's beautiful."
"Yes, she is. She's been throwing me little smiles all day, just enough to reassure me. Her beauty goes beyond the surface."
Silka turns back and smiles at the three of them. Then, with one hand, she removes the scarf from her head and waves it to them, revealing long dark hair cascading down her back. She moves with the grace of a swan, a young woman unaware of her own beauty, and seemingly untouched by the horror around her.
"You must ask her how she has kept her hair,"
Ivana says, scratching absently at her own headscarf. Geeta pulls her own scarf from her head and runs her hand over her short, spiky stubble, knowing all too well that it will soon be removed again, shaved back to her scalp. Her smile disappears briefly. Then she replaces her scarf, links arms with Dana and Ivana, and they walk towards the meal cart. Chapter 8.
Lale and Leon have been working round the clock as the Germans storm every city, town and village, and empty them of Jews.
Those from France, Belgium, Yugoslavia, Italy, Moravia, Greece and Norway join prisoners already taken from Germany, Austria, Poland and Slovakia. At Auschwitz, they tattoo those unfortunate enough to be selected by the medical team there.
Those designated to work are brought in trains to Birkenau, which saves Lale and Leon a round-trip walk of 8 kilometers. But with this many new arrivals, Lale is unable to collect the loot from the girls in the Canada, and Victor's treats go back home with him each day. Once in a while, when the numbers are dwindling and the time of day is right, Lale begs off for a toilet break and makes it to the Canada. The hoard of gems, jewelry and currency under his mattress increases. Day has become night, and still men line up to be numbered for life, be it short or long. Lale works robotically, reaching for the paper, taking the offered arm, numbering.
Move on. Next, please. He knew he was tired, but the next arm is so heavy that he drops it. A giant of a man stands before him, all chest and thick neck and massive limbs.
"I'm very hungry," whispers the man.
Lale then does something he has never done.
"What's your name?" he asks.
"Jakob."
Lale sets about tattooing Jakob's number. When finished, he looks around and observes that the SS guarding them are tired and paying little attention to what is going on. Lale ushers Jakob behind him, into the shadows, where the floodlights do not reach.
"Wait there until I'm finished."
The last prisoner having been numbered, Lale and Leon gather up their tools and table. Lale waves goodbye to Leon and apologizes that he has again missed his evening meal, promising to bring him something from his stash tomorrow morning. Or is it this morning? With Jakob still hidden, Lale stalls, making sure all the SS have moved on.
Finally, there is no one around. A quick glance at the tower posts reveals no one looking their way.
He instructs Jakob to follow him, and they hurry to Lale's room. Lale closes the door behind them and Jakob sits down on Lale's bed. Lale lifts one corner of the sunken mattress to produce some bread and sausage. He offers it to the man, and Jakob makes short work of it. When he has finished eating, Lale asks,
"Where are you from?"
"America."
"How did you end up here?"
"I was visiting my family in Poland and got trapped here. I couldn't leave. And then we got rounded up and here I am. I don't know where my family are. We got separated."
"But you live in America?"
"Yes."
"Shit, that's tough."
"What's your name?" Jakob asks.
"I'm Lale. They call me the Tetoviera. And like me, you will do well here."
"I don't understand. What do you mean?" "Your size. The Germans are the cruelest bastards ever to live, but they're not entirely stupid. They have a knack for finding the right person for the right job, and I'm sure they will find work for you."
"What kind of work?"
"I don't know. You'll have to wait and see. Do you know what block you're assigned to?" Block 7?
Ah, I know it well.
Come on, let's sneak you in. You'd better be there to answer when your number is called out in a couple of hours.
2 days later, it is Sunday. Having worked the past 5 Sundays, Lale has missed Gita terribly.
Today the sun is shining down on him as he walks the compound, looking for her. As he rounds the corner of one block, he is startled by cheering and applause. Such noises are unheard of in the camp.
Lale pushes his way through a crowd to reach its focus. There, center stage, surrounded by both prisoners and SS, Jakob is performing.
3 men carry a large piece of timber to him. He takes it and tosses it away. Prisoners have to scramble to get out of the way. Another prisoner produces a large metal rod, which Jakob sets about bending in half. The show goes on for some time as heavier and heavier items are brought to Jakob for him to display his strength. A hush falls over the crowd. Hausteck is approaching, guarded by SS. Jakob continues his performance unaware of his new audience. Hausteck watches him raise a piece of steel above his head and twist it. He's seen enough. He gives a nod to the nearby SS who advance on Jakob. They make no attempt to touch him, but point their rifles in the direction they expect him to go.
As the crowd thins, Lale sees Gita. He rushes towards her and her friends. One or two giggle when they see him. The sound is so out of place in this camp of death, and Lale delights in it.
Gita beams. Taking her by the arm, he steers her to their spot behind the administration building. The ground is still too cold to sit on, so Gita leans against the building, tilts her face to the sun.
"Close your eyes," Lale says.
"Why?" "Just do as you're told. Trust me." Gita closes her eyes.
"Open your mouth."
She opens her eyes.
"Close your eyes and open your mouth."
Gita does so. From his bag, Lale produces a small piece of chocolate. He places it on her lips, letting her feel the texture of it, before slowly pushing it a little further into her mouth. She presses her tongue against it. Lale pulls it back to her lips. Now moistened, he rubs the chocolate gently across her lips, and she licks it off with delight.
When he pushes it into her mouth, she bites down, taking a chunk off, opening her eyes wide. Savoring the taste, she says,
"Why does chocolate taste so much better when it's fed to you?"
"I don't know. No one has ever fed it to me."
Gita takes the small amount of chocolate Lale still holds in his hand.
"Close your eyes and open your mouth."
The same teasing takes place. After Gita has smeared the last bit of chocolate on Lale's lips, she gently kisses him, licking the chocolate away. He opens his eyes to find hers shut. He pulls her into his arms, and they kiss passionately. When Gita finally opens her eyes, she wipes the tears that run down Lale's face.
"What else have you got in that bag of yours?" she asks playfully.
Lale sniffs and laughs.
"A diamond ring? Or would you prefer an emerald?" "Oh, I'll have the diamond, thank you,"
she says, playing along.
Lale rummages around in his bag and produces an exquisite silver ring with a single diamond set in it. Handing it to her, he says, "It's yours."
Gita can't take her eyes off the ring, the sun bouncing off the stone.
"Where did you get this?"
"Girls working in one of the Canada buildings find jewels and money for me. That's what I use to buy the food and medicine I've been giving you and the others. Here, take it." Gita puts her hand out as though to try on the ring, but then pulls back.
"No, you keep it. Put it to good use."
"Okay."
Lale
goes to put it back in his bag.
"Stop.
Let me look at it one more time.
He holds it between two fingers, turning it this way and that.
It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Now put it away.
It's the second most beautiful thing I've ever seen, says Lale, looking at Gita. She blushes and turns her face away.
I'll have some more of that chocolate if you have any left.
Lale hands her a small block. She snaps off a piece and places it in her mouth, closing her eyes for a moment. She wraps the rest within her sleeve and tucks it away.
Come on, he says. Let's get you back to the girls so you can share it.
Gita reaches up to his face, caresses his cheek.
Thank you.
Lale sways, unbalanced by her proximity. Gita takes his hand and begins to walk. Lale is led. As they enter the main compound, Lale sees Beretsky.
He and Gita release hands. He exchanges a glance with her that tells her all she needs to know. It aches to part from her without a word, and with no certainty about when they will next meet. He walks towards Beretsky, who is glaring at him.
I've been looking for you, says Beretsky. We've got work to do at Auschwitz.
Along the road to Auschwitz, Lale and Beretsky pass work details of a few men each,
who must be being punished
with this Sunday work.
Several SS guarding them call out a greeting to Beretsky, who ignores them. Something is very wrong with him today. Normally he's quite the talker, but today his whole body seems tense.
Ahead, Lale sees three prisoners sitting on the ground back to back, supporting each other, clearly exhausted. The prisoners look up at Lale and Beretsky, but make no attempt to move. Without breaking step, Beretsky pulls his rifle from his back and fires at them repeatedly. Lale freezes, his eyes locked on the dead men. Finally, looking back up at the retreating Beretsky, Lale recalls the first time he saw such an unprovoked attack on defenseless men, sitting on a board in the dark. That first night he arrived at Birkenau flashes before him. Beretsky is getting further away from him, and Lale fears he will take his anger out on him next.
He hurries to catch up to him, but remains a slight distance away.
He knows Beretsky knows he's there. Once more, they arrive at the gates into Auschwitz, and Lale looks up at the words emblazoned above. Arbeit macht frei. He silently curses whatever God may be listening.
Chapter 9, March 1943.
Lale reports to the administration office to get his instructions.
The weather is improving slowly. There has been no snow for a week. On entering, he sweeps his eyes around the office to make sure Gita is where she should be. There she is, still seated beside Silka. The two have become very close, and Dana and Ivana seem to have welcomed Silka fully into their little circle. His customary wink to the two of them is acknowledged with suppressed smiles. He approaches the Polish girl behind the counter.
Good morning, Bella. It's a lovely day outside. Good morning, Lale.
Bella responds.
I have your work here. I've been told to tell you that all the numbers today are to have the letter Z in front of them.
Lale looks down at the list of numbers, and sure enough, each one is prefixed with the letter Z.
Do you know what this signifies? No, Lale. I'm not told anything. You know more than I do. I just follow instructions. As do I, Bella. Thanks. I'll see you later.
Holding the instructions, Lale heads out the door.
Lale?
Bella calls out.
He turns back to her. With her head turned towards Gita, she asks,
Haven't you forgotten something?
Smiling at her, he turns to Gita and raises his eyebrows at her. Several girls hold a hand over their mouth, eyes on the lookout for the SS who oversee their work.
Leon is waiting for Lale outside. Lale fills him in as they walk to their workstation.
Trucks are unloading their cargo nearby, and the men do a double take as they register there are children among those being helped down, along with older men and women. Children have never been seen before at Birkenau.
"Surely we're not marking kids. I'll not do that,"
Leon pronounces. "Here comes Beretsky. He'll tell us what to do. Don't say a word." Beretsky strides up.
"I see you've noticed something's different today, Tatoviera. These are your new companions. You're going to be sharing from now on, so you'd better be nice to them. They'll outnumber you by quite a lot. A hell of a lot, actually."
Lale says nothing.
"They are the filth of Europe. Even worse than you. They're gypsies, and for reasons I'll never know, the Führer has decided they are to live here, with you. What do you say about that, Tato Viera?"
"Are we to number the children?"
"You'll number anyone who hands you a number. I'll leave you to your work. I'm going to be busy at the selection, so don't make me have to come over here."
As Beretsky marches off, Leon stammers,
"I won't. Let's just wait and see what comes our way."
It doesn't take long for males and females, from babes in arms to hunched over elderly, to make their way to Lale and Leon, who are grateful to learn that the children are not to be numbered, though some presenting numbers seem too young to Lale.
He does his job, offering smiles to children standing by as he numbers their parents, and telling the occasional mum holding an infant what a lovely baby she has. Beretsky is well out of earshot. He struggles most in numbering the elderly women, who seem to be the walking dead, vacant eyes, perhaps aware of their imminent fate. To them he offers a sorry. He knows they probably don't understand. In the administration building, Gita and Silke are working at their desks. Two SS officers approach them with no warning. Silke gasps as one of them grabs her by the arm, jerking her to her feet. Gita watches as Silke is marched from the room, looking back with confused and pleading eyes. Gita doesn't see the administrative SS officer approach her until she is struck across the head by a hand, a clear message to get back to work. Silke tries to resist as she is dragged down a long corridor to an unknown part of the building. She is no match for the two men who, on stopping at a closed door, open it and literally throw her inside. Silke picks herself up and looks around. A large four-poster bed dominates the room. There is also a dresser and a bedside table with a lamp and a chair. Someone sits in the chair. Silke recognizes him. Lagerführer Schwarzhuber, the senior commandant of Birkenau. He is an imposing man, rarely seen in the camp. He sits tapping his tall leather boot with his swagger stick. From an expressionless face, he stares at a space above Silke's head. Silke backs up against the door. Her hand goes to the door handle. In a flash, the swagger stick hurtles through the air and strikes Silke's hand. She cries out in pain and slides down to the floor. Schwarzhuber walks over to her and picks up his stick. He stands over her, his nostrils distend. He breathes heavily and glares at her. He takes off his hat and throws it across the room. With his other hand, he continues to hit his leg firmly with his swagger stick. With every whack, Silke flinches, expecting to be struck. He uses the stick to push up her shirt. Realizing what is expected, with shaking hands, Silke undoes the top two buttons. Schwarzhuber then places his stick under her chin and forces her to rise to her feet. She is dwarfed by the man. His eyes seem to see nothing. This is a man whose soul has died, and whose body is waiting to catch up with it. He holds out both his arms, and she interprets this gesture as, "Undress me." She takes a step closer, still at arm's length, and begins undoing the many buttons on his jacket. A whack across the back with a stick hurries her up. Schwarzhuber is forced to drop the stick so she can slide his jacket off. Taking it from her, he throws it after his hat. He removes his own singlet. Silke begins undoing his belt and zipper. Kneeling down, she pulls his trousers down to his ankles, but can't get them over his boots. Unbalanced, Silke falls heavily when he pushes her over. Dropping onto his knees, he straddles her. Terrified, Silke attempts to cover herself as he rips her shirt open. She feels the back of his hand across her face as she closes her eyes and gives in to the inevitable. That evening, Gita runs from the office to her block, tears streaming down her face. Dana and Ivana find her sobbing on their bunk when they arrive a short while later. She is inconsolable and can only tell them that Silke has been taken away.
It was only going to be a matter of time. Since becoming the Tetoviera, Lale has had an entire block to himself.
Each day upon returning there, he has observed the progress made on the buildings going up around him. He is in a clearly defined camp, sleeping in the single room usually reserved in each block for the capo, even though he is capo to no one. He has always assumed that sooner or later the empty bunk beds behind him would be filled.
Today, Lale returns to his block and watches the children running around outside playing tag.
Life is not going to be the same. Several of the older children run up to him and ask questions he fails to understand. They discover that they can communicate in a bastardized form of Hungarian, albeit not always accurately. He shows his room to those now sharing his block, telling them in his sternest voice that they are never, ever to enter. He knows they understand this, but will they respect it? Only time will tell. He considers his limited understanding of gypsy culture and wonders if he needs to make alternative storage arrangements for what is under his mattress. He walks into the block, shakes hands with many of the men, acknowledges the women, the older women in particular. They know what he does here, and he tries to explain it further. They want to know what's going to happen to them. A reasonable question to which he has no answer. He promises he will tell them of anything he hears which might affect them. They seem grateful. Many tell him they have never spoken to a Jew before. He doesn't think he's ever spoken to a gypsy either. That night, he has trouble sleeping as he adjusts to the sounds of babies crying and children begging their parents for food. Chapter 10.
Within days, Lale has been made an honorary Romani.
Every time he returns to what is now officially known as the Gypsy Camp, he is greeted by young boys and girls who encircle him and ask him to play or to dig food from his bag. They know he has access to it. He has shared some with them, but he explains that he will give what he can to the adults to portion out to those in greatest need. Many of the adult men approach him daily, asking if he has any news of their fate. He assures them he will pass on anything he hears. He suggests they accept their situation as best they can, and recommends arranging some sort of schooling for the children, even if it is merely telling them stories about their home, their family, their culture.
Lale is happy to see them pursue this suggestion, and delighted that the older women are given the role of teachers.
He notices in them a tiny spark that wasn't present before. Of course, his own return always interrupts whatever lesson is underway. On occasion, he sits with them, listening, learning of a people and culture so different to his own. He often asks questions which the women are pleased to answer, further educating the children who seem more interested when
Lale has asked the question.
Having spent all his life in one home with his family,